me about three different occasions trying to get me to do this. And in this last probably a year and a half, we've gone through a lot of stuff with some properties and different things that were going on. They were so overwhelming that, you know, I didn't feel like I would be in the right stage of mind. And a lot of those things we were able to get through because of this fellowship and this program. You know, when he asked me to talk about steps 1, 2, and 3, I thought, oh, I could say, say the 3 steps and tell you that I can't, he can, and I think I'll let him, and then I'd be good to go. And because that's basically what happened. But the problem is that in order for you to understand how I work the steps and how the steps work for me, I have to talk a little bit about my past, about how I got here, in order to have a true understanding of step 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, like a lot of you have heard that my brother and I, we started in New York. I was passed around at 5 families in 3 states by the time I was 7 years old. And, you know, and you know what's amazing about life, even as a little kid with all that stuff going on, you know, between alcoholism, my mother's schizophrenia, all that stuff like that. Every single time, wherever I landed, I made it work. It worked. I found I still had that higher power. I still felt that God. I still sang my little church songs that I learned at the at the school I went to when I was a little kid, and I felt that, you know, it was all going to work out. And but I ended up in the middle of Pennsylvania and with my grandmother and my grandfather, and even though I didn't have a mother and father, I felt that my grandparents felt like really like my first mother and father. And I started putting all that trust as a little kid in those people. And it was all working good. You know, my grandmother loved to sing songs being Croatian. My grandfather and I would work in the garden. I started having this life. And one day I came home from school at lunch like I always did, and my grandmother passed away. And I remember everybody yelling and saying to me, you can't go in there. You can't go in there. I woke my grandmother up every day at lunchtime. That was my job. And I shook her and she didn't wake up. And I remember they sent me back to school. And as I walked, I was 11 years old. As I walked down to the corner, I looked up at God at that moment. I said, we're done. I'm done with loving you. And I'm done loving people. And from that moment on, I lived life without a God and people, without loving people, but only using them as pawns. And I'm going to tell you right now, it seemed to work out all right for me. We talk about that need for self-sufficiency. Okay. I wanted to run my life and be the person completely responsible. And from the time I was probably 11 or 12 years old, I took charge of my life. My aunts, who were part of my raising me, didn't understand that I did what I wanted to do, and not, it wasn't all bad. It was what I wanted to do. And I mean, I started my first business at 12 years old, selling night crawlers to a fishing place. And I started another business of washing windows and walls, and I had deals and contracts and everything. By the time I was 13 years old, I had all the money for a kid who had no parents. I had all the money I could possibly want. And I could do anything I wanted to do. And I lived that way for such a long time. That as long as I accomplished it, it would come out to me. And then the problem is, as I started drinking, I was not really good at being very sociable, but as soon as I took that first drink, I became sociable. And I'm gonna tell you, by the end, the drink did not help me in my sociability. I could not even have a conversation with another person by the end. And I get married, I have a kid, and the whole time the alcohol is in total control of me, but I think I'm in control of it. And there's no real true relationships, because see, if I put everything in my heart and soul into a relationship and it doesn't work out, then I'm a failure. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to take that chance again. I've done it too many times when I was a little kid. It's not going to happen again. And so what happens is I end up coming back to Erie. And on December 3rd of 1983, fraternity party. Yeah, most 25-year-olds don't rejoin a fraternity, but I did, because I convinced my wife that it would be a lot cheaper for the alcohol if I belonged to the fraternity again. And I, on that night, it was a Christmas party, and I crashed my car into a concrete wall. You know, you always wonder, what am I going to need to stop drinking, to at least stop for a split second? I used to be, you know, thinking that I believed that God crashed me into that wall that night. He gave me that he knew that the only way he could stop me from going on and hurting everybody around me was to completely stop me. After going to the concrete wall, I get there, my wife's about to leave me. You know, she's going to take my daughter. They're going to move in with her parents. And if I don't go to hell, I'm 25 years old. I have never even ever once thought about quitting drinking. Never. And now my wife's going to leave me if I don't. But see, I have a plan. I just got to do it long enough to get her off my back. That's all. I'm not going to really quit. I'm 25 years old. You don't need to quit drinking at 25 years old. You know, and here's the crazy part. 5 months before that, I came back from Army basic training at 185 pounds of solid muscle. And now my wife convinced me to go to this rehab down at Hammond, the care unit. And I'll be honest, at first I wasn't going to go. I finally decided, okay, I'll go. It's about 4 days. I mean, I've already gone through most of my withdrawals. For 3 or 4 days, I'm chasing little creatures around my apartment. My wife calls it a case of the flu, you know, because he's obviously something wrong with him. It has to be it's a flu. Even though she's a nurse, she doesn't want to admit that her husband's going through withdrawals. And so I go there, and they talk me into going up to the care unit. You know, and so the first thing they do when they get you there, they want to do kind of a little medical test and some different things on me. And the first thing they said, well, sir, can you step on the scale? And I step on the scale with my clothes on, probably, to be honest. I probably step on the scale with, I guarantee I had a flannel shirt. I'm from Ridgeway. I had blue jeans and I had chicken on. And I weighed, when I stepped on that scale that night, I weighed 145 pounds. I had lost probably about 40, 45 pounds at least in the last 5 months of my drinking. And then they come back with this other test. It says, sir, I just want to let you know that your liver enzymes are 6 times of a normal person. And I'm like, no. I said, first of all, the scale, it's a carnival scale. I said, this is one of those phony scales that you guys use to convince people that they have a problem. And the liver enzymes, come on. I'm 25 years old. My liver enzymes are fine. Even though I've been, for the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking, had been in and out of doctor's offices and hospitals and testing for different kind of problems with my abdominal area. Yeah, but it's not. It's, you know what it was? I worked in a colored chemical factory. It's the job. It is definitely the job. And so I'm in total denial, okay? But they said my wife's basically, I knew that my wife would leave if I didn't go in there. So I went into the care unit. Again, still absolutely no desire to quit drinking. Just wanted, I'll do the 25 days, get home. I was supposed to get out the day before New Year's Eve, but they didn't work that way. They said, we're going to keep you for an extra couple of days. But I'm in the care unit, my plan is still working. So what I did is I was having private meetings with my wife. And during these meetings, I'm telling my wife that they believe that I was too young to be an alcoholic. And that my counselor said that I'm what they call a special alcoholic, which meant that I could have 2 beers a day. And it was going pretty good. My plan of drinking, even though I've crashed a car, my liver enzymes are 6 times a normal person, I've lost 50 pounds basically in the last 5 months by drinking, there is nothing wrong with me. Alcohol has still got complete control of me. I'm in this care unit, and you know, one day what happened is families have meetings and they're all sitting around talking about their husbands and wives and how they can never drink again. And my wife said to the counselor, well, that's fine and dandy for you people, but how about my husband, the special alcoholic? And at that moment, they all looked at her like their heads turned and said, excuse me, ma'am, what is a special alcoholic? And she told him, yeah, that he could have 2 beers a day. And then they yelled my name down and they're, you know, going to throw me out. I'm like, honey, I can't believe you told him that. I was only kidding. It's a joke. It was only a joke, honey. You know, I know I can't drink because, you know, because to be honest, I had spent all the money. I'd wrecked a car. There was nothing for me to do when I went out there at first. I needed the money to be rebuilt. So I'm still sitting there, 25 years old, no desire to quit drinking. And then I'd go to they have a stupid piece of paper they hand me at 8 o'clock in the morning. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, they hand me this piece of paper. And maybe some of you guys have seen them in the rehab. It's beginning, middle, and ending stages of alcoholism. They had 40 little cute little boxes. And on the boxes, you know, it'd be like, you know, they'd ask you a question. You had to put a wire and in there. I'm like, oh my, are you kidding me? 8 o'clock in the morning, and you want me... You want me to do this at 8 o'clock in the morning? You want me to think? But so I went, okay, why, and why. Okay, I'm done. And of course, as soon as I said I was done, the counselor said, okay, well, the first person that's done is on the hot seat for everybody else. You know what these people are, you know, when these people were started doing it, asking me questions about the ones I put no's to. And I'm going, okay, yes. I'm yelling at these people like, dude, wait, it's your turn. Wait, it's your turn. You listen to the things I'm going to say to you. And I'm going down. And I got done. I had 38 yeses and 2 no's. My wife hadn't left me and I wasn't dead yet. Yeah. So it was not looking good right there. And so I'm sitting there just stewing. And I finally said, I grabbed a table, one of those 8-foot plastic tables. And I throw the table across the room like a little 2-year-old. And I ran down the hall into my room. And I locked the door. And I'm in there for like 2 hours with this piece of paper, with a stupid piece of paper saying, I'm trying to change the yeses back to no's. And as I'm doing that, as I'm trying to change the yeses back to no's, I realized, you know, and I stood up and I looked in the mirror and I saw the 145-pound looking, dumb-looking creature I had become. And I went, oh my God. You're an alcoholic. So I opened up the door and I ran down the hallway with a paper yelling, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. And they all went, no shit. You know? And I'd like to tell you, and I wrote that down in one of my pieces of paper. I'd like to tell you that at that moment, I took step one. No. Because see, I'm an alcoholic, but I can take care of this myself. I will fix this myself. I don't need your people. I get out of the care unit. I don't want God. I don't want a sponsor. I don't want these stupid steps. I mean, matter of fact, I look at the steps like, oh my God, you poor people. This is embarrassing, you know. And I was going to meetings at the club like usually once and twice a day, you know. And I'm in total denial of step one completely. You know, and I'm sitting there going, you know, I've got this. And the best part about it was my plan was that after I fixed my alcoholism, I admitted I was an alcoholic, but when I fix it myself, I'll go down in history. You know, I'll be the guy besides AA that fixed people, you know. I'm going to tell you right now, I had a wife and a daughter, and my wife's working as a nurse in the same hospital I'd gone through. And my wife would go to work and see, oh, the only problem now, I didn't have alcohol to hide from all those things that I buried down by the time I was a little kid, all the situations I was in different houses and different, and I had nothing to hide from it. And because of that, you know, I wanted to die. And I can remember for my wedding gift, my best man gave me a 30-30. And my wife would go to work third shift. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll be sitting there hating myself more than I've ever hated myself because now I have nothing to hide it from. And I'd pull that 30-30 out of the closet, and I'd put it in my mouth, and I would scream at myself, pull the trigger. Give your family a chance. Pull the trigger. I just wanted to die. I knew that I didn't want to be dragging my family down because I was so miserable every single moment. Because, see, I can't admit. I can't do step one. I can't admit that I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable. I can't do it. You know, because if I do that, I'm not the person. I've said from the time I was a little kid, I will take care of every part of my life for the rest of my life by myself. I don't want help from any person. And I keep on every single, the only thing that saved me is I had a daughter that was a year and a half old. As a matter of fact, she just turned 38 yesterday. And that daughter was in the next room, and I didn't want her to be the one that found her father. And I was just sitting there, and I would just like beg, please allow me to do this. And I'm doing this for 3 or 4 months in the fellowship. I'm going to meetings once, twice a day. I've admitted I'm an alcoholic, okay? I'm an alcoholic, but I can't. I go to meetings, and all the people talking, they're like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. I hear nothing they're talking about. I can tell you right now, they treated me well. They treated me better than I should have been treated. When the old timers would come up to me and start talking about God beside me, I'd ask them and say, hey boys, like Ormond Merle, and come up to me and go, they start talking about, I'm having a conversation, and they start talking about God right beside me. I say, excuse me, boys. I said, we were standing here first, and if you want to talk about God, you need to move over there. And they'd reach your arm out and tap me on the shoulder and say, Dan, keep coming back. You know, and I'm like, I'm not going to tell you what I'm thinking right there, you know. But that's how I was living. I'm in total misery, but I'm at least going to meetings. The one thing I did right during that period of time is I went to meetings. And as I'm doing that, it finally got to a point where one night, I go to this meeting I'd never been to before. I get there, and it's like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. This guy starts talking, and I got my head laying on a table. I'm just in total misery. I think tonight's the night I'm going to pull the trigger. And this guy gets up in front of the room, and he starts laughing and joking, and he's got an aura of peace and serenity around him, and he's just got this vision of life and how he treats people. And I can just, I'm hearing this. I'm late, and for a split second, I said, I want to feel like that. I want to feel like he feels. And as soon as he got done talking, the meeting's over, I'm pushing people out of the way. I run up and say, hey, dude, I need a sponsor right now. He says, I've never seen you before. I go, and at that moment, I think he looked in my eyes. And maybe he knew that I was going to pull that trigger that night. I always tell people, I wasn't in front of that gentleman. I wasn't on my hands and knees, but in my heart and my soul at that moment, I was on my hands and my knees. You know, I finally surrendered. And when I surrendered, that to me is when I took step one. You know, I look at, I wrote down, oh, I can tell you right now, I got all kinds of stuff beside me, all these different words. And I read it 12 and 12. I read all the different things just to kind of get myself refreshed. And I was going through it. The amazing part about it, until I surrendered, it made no sense. I can remember that first 5 months, I'd go up in the attic with a 12 and 12, in the attic with a little light on there, away from everybody, for nobody could see I was reading the book. Because see, then if I read the book and I didn't tell my wife I read the book, I could, again, tell everybody I did it myself. And I could not understand. I would read a paragraph, and then I go, what did it say? I read a paragraph, what did it say? But that's why I needed to surrender. That's why I needed to do step one. That's why I needed to find somebody in his fellowship and the people. And here's what happened. You know, when you talk about step one, you know, for me, step one and step two kind of happened at the same time. You know, admitting that powerless over alcohol and life is unmanageable, that's one thing. Becoming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. As soon as I heard that, I can remember thinking to myself, oh, no, no, no. I'll go to your meetings. I'll get a sponsor. Do not. I don't want to hear about God. I really don't want to hear about God at all. And as you read the chapters in step two and step one and step two, you hear and see all the people who kind of felt the same way. And who those people were for me is all of a sudden after I get a sponsor, you know what he started doing? He started introducing to me to his group of friends. And that group of friends started getting bigger and bigger. And they all knew that he would sponsor me. And they were like, hurting me. I felt like if I go, all of a sudden there'd be a body beside me, kind of pushing me in. And they were kind of keeping, you know, they did it. They did it by the power of example. You know, if I like to, I like to say that, you know, I didn't have a higher power. My higher power at first, and it became the group of drunks. God is, you know, go to a direction, a group of drunks. You know, I'll do the next right thing. I'll go to work, or I'll go to this, I'll do that. But I don't feel this connection that people are talking about, and which is all right. And they told me it was all right. I needed to hear that from these old timers. You know, one of the guys, you know, when you have a problem with the higher power, you have a guy named Obie O'Brien. I don't know if you guys remember him, but Obie, he had about 40, well, he finished with 46 years in his life in sobriety. You know, and the thing about Obie was, you know, he was kind of, it was like down to earth and nothing, he wasn't like elaborate talks or anything else like that. And I remember one day I'm sitting there in that meeting after, and this is after I get a sponsor, and I'm just sitting there and still can't understand why, you know, why a newcomer, like maybe 3 months, is talking about God and having a relationship, and I don't feel it. And maybe I don't really want to feel it. Maybe I'm not capable of feeling it yet. And Obie says during the meeting, well, when I first got here, I thought you were a bunch of religious fanatics. Here's a guy that had 46 years in the fellowship saying, when I first got here 46 years ago, I thought you guys were a bunch of religious fanatics. And I'm thinking to myself, how the hell does he know what I'm thinking right now? You know? And then this thought came to me. If he felt the same way, I could feel that way. Maybe, you know, we talked about it in step two. Maybe there's a chance. You know, and that little opening for me began right there. That little, like, was I going to go find a higher power then? No. You know, I can remember, like, you know, it talks about in step three, you made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And it's, oh, my God, I'm going to tell you right now. You know, they shouldn't, you know, there's a way that the program could just, you know, we could only imprint one step into my brain at a time. And I would not be allowed to read ahead. You know, okay. When you read ahead and you read all 12 steps, like the meeting sometimes, you read them and you're new, you know, I'm like, oh, crap, I'm not going that far. I'm not doing that, because there are, by step three, they're talking, you know, about God, you know, this program is definitely not going to work for me. But what these old timers said is keep an open mind. You know, when I read that again on one of the, I think it's step two or step three area about keeping that open mind. Because see, everything I was doing was not working. You know, I can remember this is a story about what one of the things that gave me some hope. I can remember early in sobriety, after getting a sponsor, we were going to meetings at least once a day, sometimes twice a day. We were going to meetings during the noon and in the evening a lot of times. And we're going to a lot of meetings together. And one day, my sponsor Dan B says to me, "I can't make the meeting tomorrow." I said, "That's all right. I got it. I'll be there." Well, you know, something came up. I didn't go. You know, and then as soon as the meeting, you know, that night, it was like about 4:30. I used to ride my bike down to he lived about 4 or 5 blocks from me. I ride my bike down to his house and knock on his door, and he goes, "Oh, hey, how was the meeting today?" I said, "Oh, the meeting was good, Dan." He said, "Oh, really? What was the topic?" And before I could catch it, I said, "Honesty." You know, and he goes, "Oh, good topic. And so then I get back on my bike. I ride my bike home. And I'm pacing around my apartment, and I'm like sick to my stomach. And I'm like, my wife goes, "What's going on? I said, "Honey, I just lied to my sponsor. I told her what I did. She said, I don't think he would have cared. I said, I don't know. I said, you know, why did she send me? Why did you do that? And I go, that's what I do. You know, I'm a liar. You know, it's what I do. I even when I can tell the truth, I lie. And I'm about an hour of being home. I couldn't take it anymore. And I remember getting back on my bike and I rode back down and knocked on a door. I said, Dean, I got to tell you something, man. He says, what? I go, I lied to you. I told you that I went to the meeting. I didn't go. He says, well, I know. I go, what do you know? He says, oh, my thing got canceled. I was there. I'm like, what? Why would you do that? He goes, this is not a program about me making you honest. This is a program about you becoming honest. And that was one of those changing moments of my life right there, about me becoming honest. A person telling you to do stuff like that doesn't always work. That's why I talk and I say it's about power of example. The guys who helped me. Now, I'm going to talk in a story about Gene Akery. Gene, who I called, you know, like Obi-Wan Kenobi or one of those guys like that. And Gene was a short little guy and he walked slow and he had this peaceful aura of serenity. And Gene said to me one day, you know, I'm struggling. And most of you guys still know me and I'm a little hyper. And then during these meetings, early meetings with these old timers, I'd go, okay, probably 5 or 6 times to the bathroom, which used to be inside of the Algonquin Club main room. And I'd go back and forth, and these old timers, some of them would say, hey, dude, if you don't learn to slow down, you're not going to make it. You know, and I'm like, and I would try to sit there and slow down. And it was like fingernails down a chalkboard. It was painful. I'm like, oh my God, how do people do this? And finally, I don't know if I can take it anymore. The meeting was over and Gene gave me one of those mafia waves, you know, come here. And I come over there, I go, yeah, Gene. He goes, you know, all those guys that are telling you to slow down. I go, yeah, Gene. He said, F them. Like, what? I never heard this guy swear. He goes, this is not a program about them telling you who you are. This is a program about you finding out who you are in this fellowship, who you really are. Because I don't know who I am. Because I lived in this world of total self and self-centeredness and selfishness for so long. I don't understand who I am. And he says, how do they not know that maybe you're really just hyper? Well, guess what? 36 years later, I'm still hyper. It's who I am. I'm comfortable with who I am today. It's part of who I am. And so with that, you know, those kind of things that these old timers did, you know, when I said that made a decision to turn my will over to care of God, my care of God were the people in the fellowship. Their guidance to me. You know, when a guy would take and tell a story about his life, when he gave a true story. I mean, I've heard some guys that gave leads that did something, and I went away and go, you know, they're just impressing, or they're just whatever. That's how I felt that moment. Maybe it wasn't, but that's where I was. And I remember hearing the different times guys would talk and they would say things and tell us things that made me feel like, oh, I belong here. This, you know, and with that, you know, now when I, like I said, I've gone through the steps several times and I've gone through the steps with a couple different sponsors, you know, but for me, you know, that fact that I could get to that point where even, you know, the last one was step three. I remember my sponsors like, okay, well, you know why I didn't want to do step three? Same reason a lot of other people, well, because I read step four. I mean, if you do step three, your sponsor is going to want you to do step four, you know? And I'm like, whoa, I got a lot of stuff to go with. You know, we're going to have to keep that one. So if I don't do step three, I don't have to do step four. And I'm going to the Monday night beginners group every Monday night at St. Vincent's. I'm going to that meeting. And every night, this old timer named John Maury, who was cantankerous to like everybody, but for some reason, he always was nice to me. And people go, well, why is he so nice to you? I don't know. I have no idea. He seemed like a nice guy to me. And they're like, no, he's cantankerous. So for every Monday, I'm leaving in a meeting, and he's in one group, but we walk out towards our cars parked beside each other every Monday night at the same time. A God plan. And God's plan was, John says to me, so have you done that third step yet? You know, your sponsor wants you to do that step for the third step. Have you done it? I'm like, no. Have you started working? I'm working on it. You know, how do you work on believing that a power greater yourself, you know, how do you work on you know, asking God for help? How do you do that? It just didn't make any sense to me. I didn't feel that connection. And because I didn't feel that connection, thank God I had a connection with the people in the fellowship, you know, that were going to take me and guide me in the directions. But he said to me one day, after like the third or fourth week in a row, he asked me if I worked and finished the third step. He looked, you know, he had a guts, and he said that he looks at me and goes, you know, have you read the third step? I said, yeah, absolutely. It says, made a decision. and as he said it, this relief came over me. You know, I heard those words and read those words 1,000 times before that moment. But that moment, walking through this dark parking lot, and this guy, old guy, saying to me, it says, made a decision. It doesn't say you're going to have to be, it's going to be final, and you have to have all the, you know, all the contracts are going to be signed, you know. It just said, made a decision. And because I've made that decision, I was able to continue my growth. I made a decision to not only ask, you know, was I asking God for help? Yeah, I find myself trying to do that. But, you know, it's not easy to do when you feel nothing. When you shut God out at 11 years old, and you say you're done and you want no connection with him, it doesn't just pop back. But I'm going to tell you right now, and I'm going to finish talking about this. I believe that the steps are worked in three different speeds. I believe they're worked in the speed that my sponsor wanted me to work them. I believe they're the speed that I wanted to work them. And then I believe it is the speed that God actually had me work them. Now, if you would have said that to me when I was, you know, 6, 8 months over or 9 months over, I could not have understood that. You know, matter of fact, as soon as you said the word God, my brain just shut off. But I can tell you right now, I know that the reason that I went through those steps that way, that I had to surrender, I had to put that gun in my mouth, I had to, I had to finally, you know, rub the guy and push people out of the way to surrender to this fellowship. Because at that moment, that's what I was doing. I was surrendering to this fellowship and saying, yes, somebody in here, this program, maybe gives me a chance to restore me to sanity. And so that gave me that little bit of hope that I needed at that moment. And then, you know, and then having these other God place these other people at different moments in my life. See, I didn't understand that then. You know, once you find that higher power, when you look back at life after it happens, you're like, oh, boom, 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 boom. Look at it. Whoa, I didn't even see those things. And they were there. I also believe that God doesn't give me anything I can't handle. You know, they say, well, why did it take that long for those things to happen? Because, and why did it happen that way? Because God knew that if I did it any other way, I wouldn't be here. That's why, you know, I talk about, you know, I've sponsored quite a few guys over the years, and a lot of them are still sober. Matter of fact, today's one of my guys, I don't know if you know Brian, Brian P., he's got 11 years in today. And here's the crazy part about this fellowship. You know, Brian had 11 years. Today's my oldest daughter's birthday. I sponsor another guy named Ryan, who a lot of you guys, if you're familiar with the conference, he's, you know, really involved in it. Ryan, his AA birthday is my other daughter's birthday. And then 5 years into sobriety, my son was born on my 5-year anniversary. I don't think anything but God could do something that powerful. So if you're, like I said, if you're new and you're going through and you're feeling the pains and the different things that I felt, understand that if you don't pick up a drink, you give yourself a chance. Those steps that we talked about tonight, you know, the feelings inside those steps, you'll get through them with the help of the people around you, you know, and you know, this pandemic is going on right now. This gives us the opportunity of meeting different people and talking to different people that I can guarantee I haven't seen a lot of you guys in a long time. But now last week when I came on, I'm like, I know everybody, you know, because, you know, this fellowship has changed my life and I'm part of it still. And that's where I'm going to finish with step 3 tonight.
All right. So that brings us now to our question and answer portion of the discussion. Who has a question that they would like to ask? And feel free to go ahead and just unmute yourself when you're ready to speak.
Could be a short one here.
All right, Jim, alcoholic.
Thanks, Jim.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Now if I can remember what my question was. Because I know while you were talking, you started out your higher power after since you walked away from God when your grandmother died. So you got a higher power here, which was the rooms, the group right. of rooms, your good orderly direction. And maybe this is going to come later on down the line in the other steps. But how did that become? How did you go from that to the higher power you have now? Because I know your higher power is different. And one other thing, my sponsor's AA anniversary and my ex-wife's birthday are the same. So there.
That doesn't mean you have to make your sponsor your ex-sponsor either. Okay.
No.
Well, first of all, like, you know, when it comes down to it, yeah, a lot of you guys know that, and that'll come up as we start going further through the steps. But about, you know, my awakening with my higher power took 4.5 years in this fellowship, and I can tell you right now. When you've been around for 4.5 years, you're going to meeting, you're helping other people, you're doing and trying to do the. I did good early direction, next right thing. I just tried to be. I was back in school. I was doing all the things I was supposed to do. I was taking care of my family, but I did not feel that connection. And it took 4.5 years in this fellowship for me to have that connection. But I'm gonna, like I said before, when you have 4.5 years in. And you get, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and you're sitting in these rooms and you're going to a lot of meetings with a lot of newcomers, and then you see them like 3, 4, 5 months down the road, like, oh, big smiles on their faces, and they're talking about their higher power and how it's changed your lives. And I'm like, and I'm leaving the meeting, and I'm being in the car, like, are you kidding me? Why him? Why him? I'm going to tell you right now, I'm so grateful that God did not reveal himself to me until I was 4.5 years in this program. Because see, I believe that I wasn't, that if he'd have come one day too early, I would not have been able to handle the emotions and the things that went on at that moment. And so I was at peace now. I mean, I was, you know, doing the next right thing, going back to school, doing, you know, going to meetings, helping people that I needed to help. I felt the connection with the program. And but the one thing that most important is, I enjoyed the people who had honest sobriety that talked about their higher power. And sometimes I lived through them and their higher power until it was ready for me to have my own connection.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
Yep.
Who else has a question for Dan?
Hi, everyone. I'm Helen. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah. Hi, Helen.
And thank you so much. It was great to hear you tonight. But one thing I kept hearing, I think, and I want you to expound on it a little bit, is this timetable for taking the steps. I have I've heard people sponsoring others and saying, well, she won't get off the second step and I don't know what to do about it. And I guess I want you to talk about the timetable of taking these steps, and especially these first three, because they're building the foundation that we need for the rest of our sobriety. So if you could address that, I'd love it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Honestly, I believe today, because of the sponsorship I do and the people I'm involved with and the relationships I build with the guys I sponsor, that I get to see how the speed of the steps are supposed to be worked. Because every once in a while, I start getting like, I'm really busy. Can't we get done? In my head, I'm like, can I get done with these? And because that's how life is. But the fact is, I feel like I'm guided at that moment, that we're guided by my higher power. And I also, like when you heard, I heard you say something about, well, that's the importance of it, is the foundation of is these three steps. Absolutely. And the one saying I have about the importance of this foundation that these three steps make is that I was always, if there was something going on, I was in need of it right now. There was no like playing around. I want it now. And I was never worked out for me. It always failed. And it wasn't until I allowed God, which I didn't even know he was doing it, to take control of the speed I was going. Now, did I do the third step? Did I do the fourth step? Did I do the fifth step? Yeah, with my sponsor, I remember doing the fourth and fifth step with my sponsor at a year. I did this fifth step. And I won't lie, we'll talk about that next week. But the fact is, when you talk about the first three steps and how important they are, is one Bible quote that it is part of my life. And that's seed scattered on shallow soil, wash away with the first hard rain. And that was a story of my life, because I never, with anything in life, did I ever build a foundation. Different things I did, relationships. No, I didn't build a foundation in a relationship. I wanted what I wanted from it, and then it would disappear. Like jobs I go to church for like a couple weeks, and they're like, oh, that's good enough, or whatever it was. I would only do it for a short period, get what I wanted after it, and then it would always just fall apart. It would just wash away. And it wasn't until I went at God's pace in this fellowship. That doesn't mean that I didn't work the steps with my sponsor at a certain rate, and I worked the steps myself at a certain rate. But I'm going to tell you right now, when you do that, when you finally have that spiritual awakening, and you see the interconnection between the time that you did it, the time that your sponsor wanted you to do it, and God's time, and they connect across each other, those moments are so unbelievable that kind of changed who you are. And they started, every time when I was a kid that any kind of fear came up, different things like that, I either fought it or ran away from it. And I ran away from a lot of things because I didn't want other people to know that I wasn't capable of doing it. It wasn't until I was in this fellowship that I started being able to tell people around me who I really was, what I was afraid of, what I couldn't do. And it had to come slowly. If they'd have come up and said, okay, you have to do it right now, this is, it's right here. Maybe for me. Does that mean it doesn't work for another person? What works for me and how I did it and how I went through it, maybe it might be different for somebody else. That's why I think the importance of this fellowship is that not only we as individuals in the AA, but we as sponsors have to understand where our people are, where they are at that moment. I have a guy that I always used to say when I got done talking with him about things that are going to happen in life. he said, he looked at me in total honesty. He would look at me and goes, I really don't understand right now, but I believe that someday I will. And that was like this like little connection right there. Yes. And I can remember like when all of a sudden he came back like 3 months later and said, you know that little thing we talked about before? I understand it now. I feel it now. I know where you're coming from. And because that's where he was. And the fact is, if I had said, no, you have to learn it right now, and at least for me, I would have ran away. So like I said, I'm just grateful that I was able to stay. Thanks.
Anyone else?
I hope that answered your question.
Dan, can you hear me?
Yes. I can.
Well, good. Hey, on the second step, being restored to sanity, when did you realize that you were insane?
Well, I'm going to tell you what, that's probably one of the great, I mean, I don't really think that people that most people I knew know, when their wife goes to work, takes a gun and puts it in their mouth. And I think when I was on my hands and knees in front of my sponsor at that moment, I knew that the only thing I could that was going to save me was this program. That I could not do it on my own. I looked. It was like I had this view of all the insane acts I had done my entire life, and without alcohol to hide them anymore. They were every single night. They would just come up and come up and come up and come up. And if you don't talk about them, if you don't tell somebody about them, they just continue. And so I think that really the fact is that at that moment, you know, where when I ask my sponsor, I always say that step one and step two can happen that fast. You know, cause especially when you, I think it happens that fast, especially in somebody who does not have a higher power, that doesn't find God. You know, that sponsor, you know, I'm not going to say he was my higher power, but he was the only person from the time I was a little kid with my grandfather that I could talk to about the things I was feeling that was going on in my life. And that, you know, so fast forward, like, you know, 15, 20 years. And now I'm able to let go of some of these things. And when you look back on my thought processes, I like, wow, that's just total insanity. And the proof of, you know, for insane as I was, to not have pulled that trigger, to you know, because it would have been easy. The only sane thought I had was I didn't want my daughter to find me. That's it. There was nothing else that would save me at all. You know, there was nothing that anybody could help me because before that point, I didn't have anybody to talk to. And when I finally asked for help, that's when I could realize that the only chance I had to get through the insanity is with this program and you people.
Thanks, Dan.
Sure.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much brings us to the end of our time for the evening. So thank you, Dan.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate you listening.
Looking forward to hearing you next week speak on steps 4 and 5. So everybody that's here tonight, you're obviously invited back and share the invitation with a friend. Look out for each other, maybe make a call out to a long timer. Keep people in mind, obviously, that are stuck at home right now. Do we have any announcements for membership before we wrap things up?
I guess somebody does.
Sorry about that.
I understand dog.
Yeah, Riley appreciated that.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to remind everybody, Greg, before, if you want any of the past speakers, we can mail those to you, and Dan's set will be available at the end of this. So if you would leave your name, address, all your vitals in the chat, and I'll mail it out to you sometime during the week. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Okay, so we close this meeting with the Serenity Prayer. Dan, if you'd like to take us out, please.
God, grant us the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.